Hi, welcome to this week's program.
You may have heard of the notorious bank robber Willie Sutton, who reportedly said, "You can get more with a kind word and a gun than you can with just a kind word." Well, these days, that's quite a quaint statement because bank robbers don't need kind words or guns. They don't even have to see anybody face to face. Guns have been replaced by credit card readers, hidden cameras, and keyboard overlays, which are the modern tools used by today's thieves. The Secret Service estimates that losses with what is generically called card skimming stands at $8 billion annually. And it's getting worse. Last year, FICO reported that skimming was up 174% at bank-owned ATMs, up 315% at non-bank ATMs. And it's not just ATMs you're at risk. Skimming at gas station pumps is also on the rise. Why the big increase? Simple. It's gotten really easy to get into this business. A crook used to have some technical know-how to make and install a skimmer. Today, complete kits are available online. And while card skimming is illegal, buying a skimmer is not. In some states, even using a skimmer to defraud is only a misdemeanor. Here's how the scam works. A skimming device is attached to the card slot of an ATM or gas pump. You insert your debit, credit, or ATM card, and the device collects data from the magnetic stripe on the back of the card. Your PIN number is captured with a hidden camera or a fake keyboard. This information is then transmitted to the thief who is parked nearby with a laptop. He can now clone your card to make purchases or sell your information online to a crime syndicate. And with your PIN number, he can basically empty your bank account. It's hard to know when your card has been skimmed. Most victims find out when they receive their monthly bank statement or get a call from the bank's fraud detection department. For some reason, I seem to receive these calls all the time. But there are simple precautions to help minimize your risk. So here's a few I listed. Number one, use ATMs that are inside the bank. Those that are outside the bank are more vulnerable to tampering. Whenever possible, use the same ATM for your cash withdrawals. You're far more likely to notice signs of a skimmer installation at a familiar machine. Try to jiggle the card reader before inserting your card. If it moves, that's suspicious, so find another ATM. Minimize your use of ATMs by getting cash back with your debit card at the supermarket, for example. When putting your PIN number in, cover the keyboard with your hand. Always assume someone is watching. If you're in a bank that has a row of ATMs, take a good look at all of them. They should be identical. You know, if you spot even a subtle difference, maybe you see one machine that's not flashing. It doesn't have a flashing card slot. So go elsewhere. Be particularly cautious on Saturdays and Sundays when the banks are closed. Crooks like to install their machine on weekends because bank personnel aren't around to monitor the machines, and it's harder for customers to report anything suspicious. At the gas station, your best defense is to pay inside or pay cash, and you know many stations give a discount for cash, so you can save some money as well. If you do pay at the pump, use a credit card, not a debit card, and use the pump that's closest to the cashier. Avoid any pump that can't be seen from the inside. And by all means, wiggle the card slot to see if it's secure. And then finally, keep a sharp eye on your bank statements. If you haven't yet done so, sign up to get online access for all of your accounts so you can regularly monitor activity and receive instant banking alerts. Think of it as an early warning system for fraud. Now, the credit card companies haven't been idly standing by doing nothing. They have created what is called EMV technology. This EMV technology has been touted as an answer to credit card fraud. EMV stands for Europay, MasterCard, and Visa, which are the three companies that created the new standard. As a result, most credit cards, probably the ones in your wallet, have been replaced by the new chip cards. The card's chip reduces the need for the magnetic stripe, which the skimmers adore. The good news is that since EMV has been implemented, there's been a 75% decrease in credit card fraud at brick-and-mortar stores. The bad news is that online fraud, where a card isn't physically used, has soared. Now, while changes in who pays for the loss now shifts to merchants not using the EMV system, not all merchants have the new chip-enabled terminals. They're still using the old terminals. As a result, the new cards still have a magnetic stripe, in addition to the chip, which means they're still subject to card skimming fraud. So, even with the new cards, your best defense is still to follow the simple precautions I just listed and trust your gut. Pay attention to your surroundings, and if something doesn't look right or feel right, don't insert your card. Move on. And I can tell you, personally, that it is a royal pain to have to reestablish your monthly subscriptions like Netflix or your utility company. So it's really in your best interest to pay attention and reduce the number of times that will happen to you. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. You might wonder why I chose this next subject as the topic for today's show. I can tell you that I think it's a need within all of us to understand, as best we can, how in an historical context we got to where we are today. Now, I'm not speaking of politics, but of the bigger picture against the sweep of history of how the world changed from old to new, the world before the Industrial Revolution into the modern world. The book that I read and that I'm referring to is entitled How the Old World Ended, The Anglo-Dutch-America Revolution, 1500 to 1800, and with me today is the distinguished author Jonathan Scott, professor of history at the University of Auckland. Welcome to our program, Professor Scott.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Professor Scott also joins us from Auckland, New Zealand, right?
Correct.
Great. So it's currently about 3 o'clock here in Florida and about 9 a.m. where he is. So let's start, Professor Scott. Why is this era that you wrote about, why is this so important to our understanding of our world today?
Well, the era is called by historians the early modern. So it's the 300 years that separates medieval from modern. And so it's the last period before, as it were, we began to live the way we do now. And one of the arguments of my book is not simply that this period shows us how we left the medieval period behind and became modern, but that change involved the greatest change and the widest ranging series of changes to human life in all of recorded history. So it's especially interesting for me.
The change you describe in your book is one, as I read it, beset by major wars, mass migrations, revolutions, violent shifts in the political landscapes, the destruction of European monarchies and the creation of new republics, and then this modern miracle of economic plenty created by these new forms of government. But was the Industrial Revolution likely, considering the way things were in medieval times?
It wasn't, is the short answer. And the slightly longer answer is that all of those developments and events that you've listed quite correctly fed into the period in a way that made the broader change that I'm trying to understand possible. But they weren't, any of them, causes of the change. The most fundamental cause of the change, or thing that permitted the change from medieval to modern, was a transition from agricultural to post-agricultural economies. And that was extraordinarily unlikely, almost impossible, and possibly accidental. The most interesting thing about this whole process that I'm trying to understand, to me, is that it could so easily not have happened or not have happened in the way that it did. And I'm trying to understand how it was possible and why it occurred in the way that it did.
Well, you know, when you describe the realities of an agrarian economy, you realize how really limiting it is to the growth of wealth for the populations it serves. For example, growing grain itself depleted the nutrients in the soil. So 1/3 of the land had to be left fallow to maintain the nutrients, and it competed with animals for pasture, also reducing the area for grain. What were some of the other aspects of living in a purely agrarian economies that kind of kept them stuck in the cycle of, you know, feast and famine?
Well, I think probably the two most important other factors were that the yields of grain agriculture were so low. So on average in Europe in the early modern period, at the end of a year of growing season, you might get 8 grains back from one that you planted. So a yield of 8 to 1, mm-hmm. It's a very small amount of food, a very small number of calories. It doesn't permit a large population. So the most important limit is that agricultural populations could never become very large because the capacity of the food supply to sustain a population was strictly limited. And then the other part of the answer is that these agricultural societies were cyclical and sustained in a cycle because the cycle was that of the seasons, their economies that entirely dependent on what they can grow, and what they can grow is controlled by the annual process of 4 seasons, and that's not under human control. Mm-hmm. Humans under the control of the climate.
But from a very unlikely place, a place where living was rather difficult because of the landscape, enter Holland, in the Netherlands, to basically begin this era of trade for the grain that they so sorely needed and could barely produce themselves. Tell us about the Netherlands and the beginning of this revolution.
Well, one of the emphases in my book is that although in the long run, understanding the transition from what I call the old world to the new is a global story, understanding how it was possible in the first place involves first looking at some very local factors, and especially at one, which is the unique geography of the Netherlands, in particular the fact that it was a water world dominated not by land or anything you could grow on land, but by rivers, the ocean, canals, and surrounding seas. And so the story about how human beings first left agricultural societies behind begins in a place where agriculture was extraordinarily difficult, mm-hmm. but where water made other ways of earning a living possible to a unique extent.
So water really provided cheap transportation for the movement of goods, which is, I think, a theme that we see all the time, whether it's the canals in England or even the Erie Canal in the United States. This idea of transporting over water back then really improved the financial capabilities of those that were using it. And the Netherlands became the richest country per capita in Europe after a while.
Yes, in fact, by a long shot, the richest. And before that, the richest region of Europe had been central and northern Italy, especially the famous canal city of Venice, mm-hmm. another illustration of the importance of these water networks.
Interesting. What year range are we talking about right now?
When we're talking about the Netherlands or when we're talking about the whole period?
Yeah, the Netherlands. The Netherlands.
So I'm talking about the development and rise of the Dutch economy, especially mm-hmm. between 1500 and 1650, so that 150 years.
Okay. So looking at the geography of the Netherlands to Britain, give us a picture of how far or how close they were to each other.
Well, they're close. Physically, the closest part of the European continent to Britain, to England, is France. It's 24 miles across the channel. At that narrowest point, you can see one side of the channel from the other on a clear day. The Netherlands isn't quite that close. You can't see it. But the networks of water transport connecting the facing river estuaries of the Thames in southeast England and the delta in the center of the Netherlands, into which 3 major rivers flow, it's those two facing river deltas and the long-established medieval and early modern networks of water transport that knit the Netherlands and England together more closely than any other two parts of northwestern Europe.
So at this point, England starts to take notice of the wealth that's being created in the Netherlands and wants to emulate what the Dutch are doing and how the Dutch had created that.
Yes.
Now, relative to the resources that the Netherlands lacked, Britain had much better resources. Tell us a little bit about what they were blessed with versus, you know, the lack thereof in the Netherlands.
Yes, this is a slightly complicated story because, first of all, yes, it's very important and it's very interesting that England had all sorts of natural resources that the Netherlands didn't have. In fact, they were almost opposite in some ways. So these are agricultural economies at the beginning of the period, and England has much more and much less challenging, much richer and more productive agricultural land. It's not flat and constantly threatened and inundated by the ocean and by salt water as the coast of the Netherlands is. It's much bigger. It has low land and upland and the capacity for greater agricultural variety. And then beyond agriculture, England also has a rich supply of much richer than the Netherlands of timber, of coal, of metals that are mined in the early modern period, especially tin and lead and iron. So it has all of those rich resources, and later in the story, they become very important to answering the question of why the Industrial Revolution occurs in Britain rather than in the Netherlands. But at the beginning of the period, it's not quite so straightforward because having been blessed with rich natural resources as an agricultural economy has the effect of making it much less likely that you will attempt to change the economy because it's working. It's in the Netherlands, where agriculture is difficult, that the Dutch, driven and challenged to make innovations which will turn out to have global importance.
I think a lot of the story, though, also has to do with the colonies or the areas that Britain had conquered and subdued and became trading partners with. They had the American colonies. They had colonies in Africa and so on. So they were able to not only manufacture goods or have goods manufactured cheaper elsewhere, but they were able to control the flow of the sale of their goods to all their colonies around the world. Now, I know the Dutch were also very adventurous and had colonies too, but did they match up with the English colonies?
The Dutch were in colonial settlements as well as in most other areas ahead of England, well ahead of England, at least a century ahead of England. They established by the beginning of the 16th century, by the beginning of the 17th century, the early 1600s, a fabulously wealthy global empire with its most important node in the Spice Islands of the Dutch East Indies, modern-day Indonesia, and England had nothing to compare with this. So the Dutch were ahead and their empire was slightly different. So one of the things that the story told in my book ends up concluding, and this was surprising to me as I was doing the research, is that England's empire is absolutely crucial to explaining how the old world ended, how industrialization became possible, but especially a particular part of that empire, that is the North American Protestant colonies settled in the 17th and 18th centuries. And those colonies were unique. They were unlike any Dutch or any other English colonies. And they were not rich. They were not economic success stories in the way that the Dutch East Indies Spice Empire was. They were colonies for settlement and the establishment of a culture and a way of life that were moderate in their wealth. But for various reasons, in the long run, they made the breakthrough in Britain that created the Industrial Revolution possible.
Yeah, so not only were Americans manufacturers of goods, maybe the cotton and tobacco and these kinds of things, raw materials that were sold, but also we were consumers, strong consumers from the very beginning. And I think maybe that story has continued. You know, I want to talk a little bit about the wars of religion that Europe went through, these horrendous casualties that it produced that you speak about in your book. Hundreds of thousands died during the German Revolution, the 30 Years' War, almost 6 million died, the Wars of the Three Stuart Kingdoms, 90,000 died, which is 4% of the population, the Scots, 60,000 died, 6% of the population, and the Irish, 660,000 people died, 41% of the population died. I mean, this period of time, mostly, I think, driven by economics and religion, would have been a time of tremendous upheaval and a horrendous time to live, I think.
Totally. It's what historians call interesting times that we should all pray not to live in interesting times.
Right.
So you're absolutely right, and thank you for focusing on this aspect of the period. So the early modern period, especially in Europe, but also in a number of other parts of the world, is extraordinarily turbulent and bloody. And this is a really important part of my story for various reasons, and I'll just pick out two. One is, as you mentioned earlier, I emphasize that the vast migrations of people set in train by these upheavals and by their religious causes especially are really important in stirring up ways of life and cultures and modes of political and religious belief in a way which stimulates the transition from what I'm calling the old world to the new world, to the modern. And then the other feature of this turbulent and bloody history, which is really crucial in my book, is that there is, in 1649, in the middle of the 17th century in England, a spectacular Republican revolution that is the final consequence of nearly a decade of civil war in England. And that revolution completely explodes the existing English state and sets in train a process of transforming the English, what later becomes the British government, creating an entirely new political and military state. And it's only in the context of those spectacular revolutionary changes that what the English learned from the Dutch can, in the 18th century, create a new global superpower. So politics and social movements and war are a tremendously important part of the overall picture.
So, Professor Scott, I noticed in the book that the degree to which a population increased seemed to have a direct effect on the power that a country was able to attain, and actually the reverse as well, that when a population decreased, it decreased a country's power. Are those two factors highly correlated?
I would say no, they're not straightforwardly correlated. For instance, in 1700, at the end of the 17th century, when Britain is starting to compete with and overtake France in terms of political and military power and economic prosperity, it has a much smaller population. France has 20 million people, Britain has 5 million. So there's no straightforward correlation. It's more complicated than that.
Okay. Well, I just noticed that the populations in these countries seem to increase pretty dramatically. I mean, they're doubling, tripling, quadrupling.
Yes.
Over a period of, let's say, 150 years. All right. The other, I think, important aspect for us all to understand is that both the Dutch and the English created new innovative financial products which were able to support the growth in trade. For example, the Dutch developed limited liability corporations. They developed the stock exchange and insurance companies, which were very important, especially these very dangerous sea trips that these many, 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 many ships would take back and forth. Talk a little bit about that and talk about some of the British innovations as well.
I think the most important thing to say about all of those innovations is that they are driven by merchants and mercantile activity and what merchants want, for instance, the capacity to insure their treasure-filled ships at sea. So they occur in places where merchants have real political power and where governments allow merchants to create new institutions in order to maximize trade prosperity. So one thing that one notices in the early modern period in Europe is that although the first rich global colonies are established by Mediterranean powers like Spain and Portugal, in the end, the economies that transform themselves and succeed are the northwestern ones like the Dutch and English. And that's because in England and the Netherlands, it's merchants who have or acquire the power. And in Spain and Portugal, the crown keeps enough power to stop merchants, as it were, getting in control and establishing and changing the institutional environment.
Yeah, this is very much what I said in the beginning, the change from the monarchy form of government, monarchical form of government, to the republic form of government, giving the people more power. And this mix of people, you know, creates this amazing growth in culture, in trade, and so on. And we continue to see that in economies of today. Those that are stiffly ruled, you know, by a powerful head of state have more difficulty growing than those that don't. So the British invented the use of national debt And you wrote that it's one of their secret weapons in the endless wars of the 18th century, this idea that it was good quality debt, well-financed debt.
Yeah.
So it allowed them to do more with less.
Yes. It's important to note here that, as with almost everything else, the British didn't invent it, the Dutch did. What the British did is they transformed it and changed its institutional structure. So that in the case, that's the Netherlands who invented what was there called renten, which is lending by merchants guaranteed by a local legislature, what are called the states in the Netherlands, lending to the monarch because the legislature has guaranteed that the money will be repaid. Nobody trusted monarchs to repay political loans, but when representative institutions were prepared to guarantee them, these instruments became very successful. So what happened is the Dutch invented that. The English copied it, but they then applied it on a national scale by creating the Bank of England, a national bank, and by linking the Bank of England to the English Parliament, the central political institution, as the guarantor institution. And what that created was a spectacular new instrument of public credit that enabled the government to spend on war and everything else out of all proportion to its tax revenue.
The book is How the Old World Ended the Anglo-Dutch American Revolution from 1500 to 1800. We spoke a lot about the Anglo and the Dutch. We didn't really get to the Americans, so I would invite you all to take a look at this book and read it. It's quite fascinating, very well researched and very well written. My guest, Professor Jonathan Scott, thank you so much for joining me, Jonathan.
Thank you so much, Steve. It was good to talk.
I hope you agree that this is pretty fascinating stuff, and it gives you an idea of why and how we got to where we are today. So to hear this in any interview again, and if you have any questions, you know, as I've always said, we love to get your questions, especially about these wonderful topics that we've discussed, whether it's about the history of our presidents, as I did recently with David Rubenstein, or about the history of the world. Generic topics you're really not going to hear in many financial shows, but I think it all fits into the context that we all need to live successfully in today's world. So come to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com, and while you're there, sign up for our weekly update for upcoming live events and the important topics we've covered this week straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. It's time for a real estate roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So fundamentally, things are changing in the real estate business, and buying and selling is changing, which is natural as new technology comes afoot.
Sure.
So let's take a look at historically how buyers were categorized and how they're being categorized today.
Sure.
So number one, there are top tier buyers. These are people willing to pay a premium. And this group looked for move-in ready homes that had all the amenities they were looking for.
That's right.
You see that all the time.
Yep, sure do.
Then there's the middle tier buyer who looks for homes in original condition. And the group hopes to get a decent price and then improve the home over time with sweat equity.
Yep.
You see that a lot?
I do.
And then finally, the bottom tier buyer, this is the third group where contractors and flippers are looking for distressed properties they could buy for 60 to 70% of retail value. Seeing much of that?
No.
Not. Okay. Well, according to this article, the middle tier, which historically represented a significant percentage of market sales, is disappearing. And the reason is that current buyers are more comfortable with tech than they are with construction. And they forego the middle tier because they want to pay more for move-in ready homes that look like the finished properties they have seen on HGTV,
which was the
subject of another episode that we did here. So take me into your world and tell me what you think.
You know, people, first of all, when you think about it, you're talking middle tier sellers. In every market, that price point is different. But the middle tier buyer is buying their second home, move-up buyer, transferring buyer. So time is an issue, and as so is cash. So traditionally, if you're buying a home that needs to be renovated, you have to have the money to A, buy the home, Then you have to have the money, cash, to put into the home, to pay the contractors, to make the renovations.
Sure, that's not always available.
So those are a little bit of a deterrent. Mm-hmm. So they would prefer in many cases that it already be done. The tricky part is that the house that they're looking to purchase, if they're going to pay that premium, they want it to be done the way that they want it. So what I see, Steve, is a very trendy thing. So what I don't care about these is they'll buy a home where somebody has renovated it to the newest, trendiest items.
That's not good.
And attractive for the moment.
Yeah.
But now you just paid a premium for that, and it's going to go out of style in 2 years.
Yeah, but you're looking at it from a business point of view.
Yeah.
This is your home, and your home should be the way you want it. You have to live in it every single
right.
day.
That's right. So don't go chasing the trend. I guess that's my message in all of this.
Yeah.
So the middle tier people, they want some of those features. Some of them will say, well, I don't want to pay for this. And then they'll just want to do it on their own. But it's gotten a little complicated.
My personal situation is that I never had the time or the experience to bring in serious contractors. And I didn't want to live through that headache. I wanted a home that was done.
Yep.
And we found one. But that's not to say that I haven't continued to improve it and continue to spend money, because, you know, it's this constant outflow of money.
It's very
constant. I always tell the story about how a young couple came to me once many years ago, and they said, you know, Steve, we want to save money. We want to buy a house. And I was like, that's so cute, you know, because I've spent so much money on my home.
You know, I redid my kitchen 18 years ago, and I'm redoing it again.
Oh.
So if I keep staying in the house.
That's not so bad.
I'm not going to put a whole lot of money into the kitchen, because I'm going to be changing it again in 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the other thing too is,
you got to make it the way you want it and like it.
That's right. When people calculate their returns on real estate,
they
calculate what they paid
and what they're selling
and what they're selling it for. They forget, and they probably haven't kept all the records anyway, and don't know how much they've put in the meantime.
Yeah.
Years ago, I was asked to do a study for the Palm Beach Post, and this was when real estate was advancing at double-digit rates of return. Remember?
In
04?
Good old days.
Yeah. And I said, well, real estate appreciates about 3% a year. And they go, oh, no, it doesn't. I said, yes, it does. This is the way our numbers work. And these are the national statistics. They refused to run that quote because they were just running what was hot and popular. They were part of the hypnosis that fueled.
Like we're going to continue to grow at 10% a year.
Exactly. But the bottom line is I was putting in what's called depreciation, which is the fact that homes, bricks and mortar, are deteriorating every minute of the day.
And land appreciates.
Okay.
Houses depreciate.
Houses depreciate. So you got to balance the two of those things. That's a very good point. I don't know how we got off on that tangent, but it's pretty interesting. All right. So here's 5 seller myths. And we've talked about this off air, and I think this is kind of true. Number one, I do not need to have the listing agent visit until my home is ready.
I disagree with this. I think it's better for you to bring in the realtor before you put the home on the market so that they can help you determine what should be done and what shouldn't be done. Because you may think something should be done, and I can't tell you how many sellers think, oh, I need to do this, when in reality, they don't.
Also, you're already going to be paying the expert.
Right.
Right? So you might as well get them in and use their knowledge.
That's
otherwise than trying to do it yourself.
That's right.
That's a rule of thumb for me, is bring in experts all the time. Number two, I do not need to upgrade the property for sale.
It just depends on what we're talking about as far as upgrades. And again, that's when a realtor can come in and help. If you're going to spend $1,000 in painting it, and a buyer's going to come in and think it needs $10,000 worth of painting, it's worth spending the $1,000 in painting. Mm-hmm. That's just a small example.
Well, what if you don't really, I guess you're going to paint it a beige or something.
A neutral color.
Neutral color.
If you have wild colors, I can tell you that they don't show well on the photos.
Yeah.
They're going to bypass your home. Yeah. We talked about this earlier, that the internet's so important. Everybody's making their buying decision within 10 seconds.
Right.
So it really needs to look sharp.
Wow. Okay. Number three, I need open houses to sell my home. We talked about this recently. You're saying not really so much.
No, not really so much. Open houses are a great way to get additional exposure, but the reality is, again, the buyers are making their buying decision on what they want to look at online, and will schedule an appointment to look at the home.
Right. Are the days of people getting in their car on Sunday and driving around neighborhoods and going to open houses, are they still around?
No.
No?
I shouldn't say that. I mean, we just did an open house and we had 15 sets of people come through.
Okay.
So, and there were some people that they were just driving around.
Yeah.
You know, it was a beautiful day. They were just meandering around. They saw the open house. It's the curiosity. A lot of it, they're looky-loos. That's what we call them.
They're probably your neighbors.
And they're neighbors, a lot of neighbors, but they're looky-loos. Yeah. You know, oh, I wonder what this looks
That's
like.
Right, exactly.
It's just curiosities.
Okay. Number four, I need many open house signs at multiple key intersections. I don't think that's
I think that's deal. A yes as an agent.
Okay. Well, I love honesty. And number five, if buyers really want my house, they'll pay more than market value.
Yeah, no.
No.
That's a simple okay. flat out no.
Well, let me say this. If the price is too high, now I'm not talking about egregiously.
Right.
You know, I get the feeling that that precludes someone from making an offer, but it seems to me if they want to make a lower offer, they should make a lower offer.
They don't.
They
it's human nature.
Why?
Buyers only buy what they perceive to have good value, period. I'm telling
and
you.
And they're not going to set the value by offering a price.
No. I've had clients say to me, when he lowers his price and is more realistic, yeah, then yeah. I'll make an offer. They also believe this. Now, listen, sellers, this is really important. They feel that if it's overpriced, and they know the values, they've looked at all the homes, they feel that the seller's not going to be realistic and worth
working with
because they're not realistic in their asking price. And that's the reason why.
Good advice from Terry Story. Terry is a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. The book, Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Know All the Facts. Now, what makes this book special is that it's written by Annie Duke. Now, you may recognize her name. She went head-to-head with Joan Rivers on The Celebrity Apprentice. But more importantly, she's one of the top poker players in the U.S. She's earned a World Series of Poker bracelet, and she's the only woman to win the NBC National Poker Heads-Up Championship. But there's more. Annie started her career as an academic going for a PhD in cognitive science before she went into poker. So she mixed those two things together and produced an amazing guide to making better decisions, and that's the book, Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Know All the Facts. And welcome, Annie Duke.
Thanks for having me.
It's a great book. It's filled with so many stories and ways to think and the ways to change our thinking in order to get better outcomes. But at the outset of your book, you tell the story of Super Bowl 49. The Seahawks coach Pete Carroll made one of the most controversial calls in football history. Briefly describe that for us.
Sure. So it's the end of the fourth quarter. There's 26 seconds left in the whole game. The Seahawks are on the Patriots' 1 yard line. It's second down. They have one timeout, and they're down by four. So what's important to know here in terms of kind of why there was this reaction to what happened is that there's a consensus play that Pete Carroll can call, which would be a running play, to hand it off to the running back, Marshawn Lynch, who's one of the best short yardage running backs in the history of the game. So everybody's expecting on second down, 26 seconds left, down by four, that he's going to hand it off to Marshawn Lynch. Marshawn Lynch is going to try to sort of barrel through the Patriots line and attempt to score. Instead, Pete Carroll does something really unexpected. He calls for Russell Wilson to pass the ball. Russell Wilson does pass the ball. The ball is quite famously intercepted in the end zone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really recommend that people go, you can find it on YouTube. Go listen to Chris Collingsworth call this. So, you know, the ball's intercepted. Obviously, the Seahawks lose because of this. And Chris Collingsworth is just going, I cannot believe this call. What was he thinking? That call was ridiculous. And then when you looked at the headlines the next day, there were a variety of headlines, most of which were declaring it to be the worst call in Super Bowl history.
Super
I think Bowl. USA Today called it the worst call in football history.
Okay, so let's step back and examine what's going on here. He had to make a decision. He made a decision in a world or a time period of uncertainty. He had only so much time to bring in all the facts that he could, knowing that skill was going to play a part, some luck was going to play a part, and he had to make a decision. He made a decision that had a bad outcome, but was his decision wrong? What do you think?
Yeah, so I think you actually made the good point of, you pointed out that there was, you know, he only has the information that he has and the time, which is short, that he has to make that decision. And then also, there's a lot of luck in the way that it turns out, right? We know that the ball could be caught, the ball could be just, you know, incomplete, it could be intercepted, you know, there could be a fumble, you know, there's all sorts of different ways that the future can kind of occur there. And there's only one that can occur. And in large part, you know, once Pete Carroll calls that pass play, how that actually ends up turning out is pretty much due to the luck,
mm-hmm.
which of those things actually occurs. So the question you should really be asking yourself is, like, how often does the ball get intercepted there?
Yeah.
You know, is it 40%? I mean, if it's 40%, it's probably a really bad call. But it turns out that when you actually do the math, it's somewhere between above 0% and below 2%.
Really?
So it's that range. Yeah. So if you look over 15 years of data from the NFL in that, you know, short yardage, I think it was a slant play, but that short yardage play, like, you know, in the red zone, the interception rate over 15 years was, you know, around 2%.
Yeah.
You know, so, and, you know, can you aggregate across 15 years? I don't know, like, you know, the coverage has changed, but let's just say it's 2%.
Mm-hmm.
So 98% of the time, that really horrible result doesn't occur. And what you're getting exchange for making a pass play there is that if the ball is incomplete, if you don't actually catch it for a touchdown with a win there, the clock actually stops naturally on its own.
Which is good.
Instead of having to burn your timeout, yeah. And then you can go hand it off to Marshawn Lynch anyway.
Got it.
You still get to run that. So mm-hmm. it costs him this, like, really low interception rate. And it was a really, really, really unlikely event.
Yeah.
And yet people acted like it was inevitable.
Well, you know, there's this idea that if your probabilities are 80 favorable and 20 unfavorable, that, you know, you're probably going to win, but someone's got to be in that 20% category. And that's unknowable. And that's really part of the risk. Now, you play poker. Every hand, you're trying to determine what you know and what you don't know and what you can discern from the other poker players across the table. How do you do that so quickly and know that you're making the right decision and also know that you've made the wrong decision?
Yeah, so in the moment, I think that one thing that's really important is to sort of get away from this idea of no, right? It's to really embrace the uncertainty that, given the information that I have, this is my estimate of the probability of one or the other things occurring. And what are the things that you're trying to get at there? Well, your opponent's cards are face down to you. So you're trying to figure out sort of what the range of possible hands that they could have is. And the better player you are, the better you are at kind of narrowing down what the possibilities are for your opponent's cards. And then once you figure out what your opponent's cards are, you have to figure out how your opponent's going to react to those cards.
Yeah.
That's really important because one person could have a pair and think it's, you know, the bee's knees, and another person could have a pair and think it's a really horrible hand. So how somebody perceives the hand is going to be different and how they might react to the hand.
Yeah.
So you're trying to sort of plug those variables in, get a guess at that, and then take a look at how often, given these things that I'm sort of guessing at, what's the probability I think that I'm going to win this hand or lose this hand, and then figure out if you're getting the right return on investment. So you kind of get out of this idea of no.
Yeah. Knowing.
Yeah, knowing. And what you say is, no, I'm estimating. I'm estimating what my probabilities are, and I want to get better and better at that so I can figure out if, given the amount of uncertainty that I have, if I'm going to get enough back. And you can think about that in terms of the Pete Carroll play. You know, there's all sorts of stuff that he knew and all sorts of stuff that he didn't know. Just like at the poker table, he had a time limit on making a decision. He made the best decision that he could, given what, you know, the things that he was guessing at about, you know, what the Patriots' coverage was going to be, how much they might be expecting a pass play versus a run play, how good their defense was, all this stuff that he's estimating.
Yeah.
And then he says, well, I think it's really low probability that the ball is going to get intercepted. But the fact is, just as you said, I can make a decision that's going to work out 80% of the time. And if the 20% happens, it doesn't mean the decision is wrong. It means the 20% happens.
Let's get to human nature for a second. So our nature, our biases lead us to think that if we have a successful outcome, we've made a good decision. But if we have an unsuccessful outcome, it's bad luck.
Right.
And it's, you know, you didn't get the promotion, not because it was you, because, you know, you did your best. It's because, well, you know, they were a favorite or, you know, whatever the reason was. People tend not to take the blame for their own mistakes, and therefore they don't really move forward in learning how to be more successful.
Yeah, so I think this stands in contrast really nicely with what happened with Pete Carroll. So when you're sort of judging the quality of a decision from afar, right? Like, I don't have anything to do with Pete Carroll. You do this thing called resulting, which is like, if it's a bad outcome, I assume it's a bad decision. If it's a good outcome, I assume it's a good decision. And you kind of try to make that one-to-one mapping and you ignore how much luck might be in the equation. But what's interesting is that stands in pretty stark contrast to what we do for ourselves, which is we engage in this thing called self-serving bias, which is when it's a really good outcome, you know, we want it to be because we're awesome. Mm-hmm. And when it's a bad outcome, we want it to not be our fault. We want it to be like, I can't believe that happened to me, or that was really unfair, those kinds of things. And both really stop you from learning.
Hey, I'm talking with Annie Duke. Her book is Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Know All the Facts. Annie, we were talking about why we always have to kind of create a story for ourselves where we are awesome. It's part of human nature, as you say. And actually, when you look at the way we're wired, that's actually a good thing, even though it can lead to a bad result. I know that sounds confusing. Take us through that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, you know, obviously, nobody wants to be depressed, right? Like, I mean, we all want to think well of ourselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is important for us to think that we're sort of good at what we do. The problem is that it depends on whether you're valuing, like, how are you judging whether you're awesome or not? Are you judging whether you're awesome in the short run? Or are you judging kind of your awesomeness in terms of like achieving your long-term goals? So if you're judging your awesomeness in the short run, that you just don't want to feel sort of the pain of taking on the responsibility for something bad that happened, or the pain of a missed opportunity to take on the responsibility for something good that happened, what happens is you're making these decisions to feel good in the moment. And it's really bad for learning because we know that all good things aren't the result of great decision-making.
Yeah.
It's some combination of decisions and luck, and all bad things aren't the result of bad luck. It's some combination of decisions and luck. In the simplest sense, think about if you apply that strategy to drunk driving. Like, you drive drunk, you get home safely. Hey, that's a good outcome.
Yeah.
I must be a great drunk driver. You know, I mean, so we don't want to come to the conclusion that we're a great drunk driver and other things we're doing, whether it's like business or sales or like the way we're treating other people or our investment decisions. You know, just because we have these good outcomes to be like, I'm a great drunk driver. We want to try to figure that out. So it's good to change what your definition of being awesome is. So I like to think of awesome as doing the really hard work of, you know, when I say, ooh, I had a really good result, but I think some of it was due to luck. That actually makes me feel good. It's taken a lot of training for me to get there.
Yeah.
Or when I have a really bad result saying, you know what, I think I might have made a mistake here. That makes me feel good as well. And the reason why is that when I do that, what I'm trying to focus on is this is going to improve my decisions going forward. So the next time I go to get in a car when maybe I've had too much to drink, I don't do it.
Right.
Because I've been willing to take responsibility.
Andy, let me move on here and talk about the necessity of feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whenever you're at the poker table and someone bets a certain amount in a certain way, that's feedback. You mentioned in the book this idea of conditioning, and they were using rats to test conditioning, and they would have a rat pull levers. And for every 10 times the rat pressed the lever, the rat would get some food. But then in the experiment, they introduced uncertainty where on average, every 10 times the rat would get some food, but it wasn't exactly every 10 times because he may press the lever 20 times and not get anything, or press it one time and get something. So now you've created an amount of uncertainty, even though the average amount of lever pulls is the same. In investing, it's very similar. You know, I think saying the word average in investing is a very dangerous word. And I often tell people, you know, how can you drown in 6 inches of water when it's average 6 inches? And the answer is, well, it's 50 feet in the middle of the lake. It's centimeters at the beach part of the lake. So the average is 6 inches, but you can drown. So average is dangerous. Take us into the world of average and uncertainty and tell us what you make of that.
So first of all, I really appreciate what you just did, because I don't think I've talked to anybody who's talked about that bit about the, you know, classical conditioning and rats pressing levers that I have in the book. So I really appreciate it. You are the first person who's mentioned that. So thank you.
Luck, by the way. That was skill.
Yes, no, that was totally skill. Well, it was luck that you were the first person that mentioned it, okay. But it was skill that you noticed the importance of it.
Okay.
So the idea is that we can kind of think about what makes it easy to learn from something and what makes it hard to learn from something. So there's two things that make things easy to learn from. The first is that the feedback comes in time for you to do something about it. So, you know, like obviously if you started smoking in 1920, even though, you know, you're destined for emphysema at some point, by the time that you get that feedback, it's too late to do anything about it. So we want to get something back that tells us about the quality of our decision quickly. That's thing number one. But also thing number two, which is what you pointed out, is that there's a really strong correlation between the feedback you get and the decisions that you're making. And this is the difference between a rat pressing a lever every 10 times, which is very consistent feedback, and introducing this uncertainty of on average, which makes it harder to know if I press the lever, am I going to get food or not? Because it's an on average thing. I don't know if it's going to be the next press or the next 20 presses. And that actually makes it really hard to learn from our outcomes.
Aren't the slot machines
based
upon the fact that there may be a win on average every X amount of times, but the period is totally uncertain?
Yes. And what's interesting about that is that once you have people sort of trained on those slot machines, that they're getting these, you know, variable rewards, you could actually turn the slot machine off in the sense of make it so it doesn't pay out at all.
Mm-hmm.
And people would sit at those machines for a very long time. And you know what they would say, right? I'm due. This machine is due.
It's time, right?
Right. And so they're not learning from the feedback that they're getting, that the machine isn't paying out, to actually get up and walk away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is true in our lives as well, is that we pick out, like, we're trying to find the signal in the noise, and we're very often taking the wrong lesson. So when we go back to this thing of self-serving bias, think about what that's doing for you, right? It's like, if I have a good result, I'm going to repeat that decision over and over again. Well, why can you do that? Well, because the outcome could be because of your decisions. It could be because of luck, and we're not 100% sure.
We're never sure.
So you choose to repeat the decision over and over again. It's like continuing to press the lever. And now in the future, when you don't have the same good result that you had the first try, you pawn it off to luck.
Yeah.
So how do you learn then? It's like you have a good result. You're like, I'm awesome. I'm going to keep doing that decision. And now you do that decision again. You have a bad result and you say, well, this time it's because of luck.
I think that happens a lot. I think that happens a lot in the investment world. You know, I've been in it for over 30 years. And you see managers come and go. You see them with a particular strategy that seems to work extremely well. And you think it's skill. But then the metrics of the world change, and now that strategy stops working, and you really wonder how much of that was skill, how much was luck. As a matter of fact, one of the biggest hedge funds just almost collapsed because they made a few terrible bets using the same methodology he was using that made him so successful in the first place. So, you know, there's this problem. The problem is not the market. The problem is not that you're not making enough money at work. The problem is you, that you haven't really figured out how to overcome your biases.
Yeah. And so I think that this is one of the lessons that is really important to take from this, is that, you know, we're not that different from rats in terms of the way that our brains are built when it comes to dealing with this kind of uncertainty
mm-hmm.
in the relationship between the feedback that we get and the actual quality of decisions. We just like to interpret the world to affirm our own beliefs, to affirm our own positive self-narrative. And we're kind of sort of stuck in that.
What do we do? What do we do to fix this?
So number one, let me just say, like, being smart isn't particularly helpful. And if people are interested in that, they can go read the section of my book that's about that. I think that it's titled Being Smart Makes It Worse.
Mm-hmm.
So
what do you do if you're smart?
Well,
you have to become humble. That's what it
right.
is. You have to say the three words, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. And then understand the value of other people helping you in the process. So I'm sure you've had this experience. Like, you see somebody doing something, you know, or stating something or applying this, you know, same old strategy that you can see very clearly isn't working anymore. And it's so clear when somebody else is engaging in behavior that's like biased or not rational
right.
or whatever. You can see it crystal clear. But when it comes to your own behavior, it's like when I talk about somebody else, like, oh, they won once and then they lost five times in a row and they're just blaming it on what luck. And you can say, like, oh, that's really dumb.
Mm-hmm.
But you do it for yourself. You're like, no, it really is luck this time because it's me.
Right.
So,
okay.
Take that.
So,
like,
number one,
get other people involved.
Okay, get other people involved. Try not to be too smart. Right. I guess that's it.
Right.
I mean, even Buffett says that, you know, he'd rather hire someone who didn't have, you know, a high IQ. It doesn't take a high IQ to be successful in the world of investing. It takes you to understand your behavior and your biases and to learn from them.
Hmm. Yeah. So, you know, start saying I'm not sure more and recognize that you need to be humble in the face of what you're doing, because what you're doing is probably pretty complicated. Because even like, you know, driving a car is really complicated, and yet we're all pretty overconfident about that. So number one, just recognize that what you're doing is probably pretty hard. And while you might feel that you can make, you know, you're better than on average at making those decisions than other people, you're not better than the game that you're playing. So that's number one. Hmm. Number two is recognize the power of getting other people to help you. That it's not shameful to say, I had a bunch of other people help work this decision with me. It's not like you deserve less credit, because you should get credit in the first place for recognizing that you're better off bringing other viewpoints into the room, that you're better off having people challenge you about why you might be wrong. You're better off, here's one of the key things, you're better off having someone make you really rationally justify your decision, where you're not allowed to just say, I know it, I feel it, you know, this is my experience, I'm smart, so I just know this is right. That you have to actually be able to defend your position. Because if you can't defend your position to somebody who's really honestly and seriously challenging you on it, then you don't know anything about your decision. And that's really sort of taken as far, you know, if you can take John Stuart Mill to get to that. And I think that that's, you know, also a form of humility and also a form of recognizing that you don't lose credit because you got help.
Okay, we have to stop there. The book, Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Know All the Facts. My guest, Annie Duke, studied cognitive science in school and is one of the top poker players in the United States.
Well, I used to be. I retired in 2012.
Well, we never talked about The Celebrity Apprentice, and I'm so happy about that. See how smart I am?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, Annie, thank you so much for joining us. And listen, if you have a question about what we just discussed, go to stevepomerantz.com and ask us anything you like. That's stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly newsletter. It comes into your email. You can see all of our segments like this one. You can read it. You can listen to it. Whatever you like, stevepomerantz.com. Annie, once again, thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform, and of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.